Okay, hello. Can you hear me? Yeah, good. All right, so this talk is going to be a bit little different, I suppose. I don't really study epilepsy directly, especially not these days. And so I thought, as a theoretician in the Neuroscience Institute at Georgia State, I figured I'd give a perspective that might be interesting to some of you. And it's inspired by an approach that was handed to me by my previous mentors, Bardem and Trout and Nancy Capel, when I was a postdoc in Boston. And it relates to a bunch of other workers too as a precedent. So not pretending I've come up with all of these ideas by myself. So I'm going to start with a straw man, I suppose. Okay, so I'm going to play the role of a skeptic in this talk. Okay, and I'm going to start with my straw man, which is Henry Markram. And he claimed a couple of years ago that we will build a brain in 10 years. I'm sure many of you have seen this kind of work. Okay, and then another quote from Einstein is that you do not really understand something unless you can explain it to your grandmother. And I foresee a problem here. Okay, so two questions, they're both rhetorical, right? Will we understand multiscale diseases such as epilepsy once we build Markram's simulated brain? The second rhetorical question is, what do we do with all the partial models of epilepsy that we have built? Right, so I'm really taking this big picture look at this. And I don't pretend to have answers to those questions, although I have my own personal, you know, thoughts about that, which I'm sure you'll glean from my talk. But the specific questions that I'm actually going to address are these. So given that we can all perceive some kind of gap between these questions, these sort of worlds, what's missing in our methodology as it stands right now? Okay, what could we do differently? And so how might we better proceed? And this is where I'm sort of playing this devil's advocate role. So I do computational modeling, and I do similar things to what have been talked about earlier. But I want to take this sort of futuristic look and see what we could do. So let's say some things that it's not, I believe. Right? It's not for lack of effort in modeling. And my colleague, Kay Natoff, who's been mentioned a couple of times so far, just published a paper that gives this nice graph for models of epilepsy. And it's a typical kind of graph that you see in a review paper about these kinds of things. Epilepsy being a multi-scale disease, different people take different approaches that fit in different places. And what's telling to me, as there's plenty of effort going on, right? Everyone's got their own problems that their lab's working on, and they're answering questions and so forth, right? But what's telling to me is how there's very little overlap between these boxes. And when there is, we don't know what to do about it. Right? Now, this paper is the one that I published with Tay, and I'll be mentioning just a small amount about that shortly, but it's not really the key idea in my talk. So let's do the ethnography about modeling here as a community. I think the issue about modeling in terms of the effort is that they're often developed in isolation with a process that's subjective and esoteric. And in particular, we are always asking ourselves, what biological parts and relationships do we represent? And as we've, you know, as all of you, I'm sure, are aware, there's a lot of curve fitting that's done, and that's sort of seen as often a problem. I think the biggest problem is that assumptions are implicit in a lot of the models that we make. Okay, and they're often strong and made a priori. Now, as a mathematician, that's dangerous ground. Because when you make strong assumptions and then they're implicit, that's going to cause problems later on. And the danger is that when there isn't a lot of mathematical training, I suppose, and the community is not used to modeling in a way that makes these assumptions very explicit, and I'll explain exactly what I mean by that later, then a lot of things can go wrong. And the kinds of things I'm talking about are when, in fact, we've already touched upon some of these ideas with talking about weak coupling and being near a limit cycle and so forth. Those are at least relatively explicit, but there are dangerous ones that are less so. So these multiple scales turn out to be not so well separated and so forth. Okay, but characteristically, how these assumptions break are actually the things that we do want to know about in order to understand how to fit different kinds of models together. And that's what's really missing, I think, in the community at the moment. So that's what we call model interoperability. Right, so that's incompatible or compatible assumptions. And also interesting that Steve mentioned weather, climate modeling earlier, because despite its many successes, if you actually talk to the practitioners, they readily admit that what they do is they just bundle together a lot of pieces that they barely understand at a really, really deep level. And it sort of works some of the time. And they even have this thing called a key and lock, which is where they pass through all their models through this keyhole, as they like to call it, because many of the models that they come up with, when they make predictions with them, the predictions turn out to, you know, say like there'll be a sunny week in England over the summer or something like that, and there's just completely unreasonable outcomes for these models. And so they have to, but the system doesn't inherently control for that, because there are a lot of mismatched assumptions that go on in these models. And so somebody has to supervise and just, you know, let go of some of those outcomes. So there's actually a lot of problems in putting together these composite models at cross scales. And we don't talk enough about that. So it's difficult to reconcile predictions when we have these different models that we're trying to make talk to each other, and to do things like trust and adapt parameter values to reuse them or compose models in different ways. And we really don't do enough about understanding the space of possible models around not just what we need to solve at this very moment for our particular problem, but to give the community a better sense of, well, where does my model and my sort of prediction fit in the larger space of what's going on in this area? If we spent more time doing that, I think that would help us to connect each other's models together and start building towards a better sort of sense of how to understand causal mechanisms that arise, as we believe, as sort of materialists, to arise from the details of sort of cellular level things rising up to systems levels in a way that we really do understand. Okay, and so, you know, models are much more fragile than we like to admit, especially in print. Okay, when we publish about this stuff, we mask those issues, and I think that's a bad thing that's going to bite us in the backside pretty soon if it hasn't already. Okay, so just to mention my little piece of work on epilepsy. Not that I think this is a particularly great model, but I think it at least has a couple of flavors that I want to highlight. So we didn't do any curve fitting. We sort of built models in the hippocampus to represent the role of network connectivity, in particular small world coupling. And that actually covers the concept of hubs that was brought up in this morning's talk. So this sort of captures the same issue. And we did some, first of all, we did simulations in a very large scale model with the same kind of coupling, and then we made two levels of abstractions until we ended up with a very abstract model that we derived in a principled way from the detailed simulations. And, you know, whether or not our predictions are necessarily correct or whether some of our assumptions were necessarily good, I think the spirit of that is what I'd like to advocate. Right? So in a sense, we were trying not to do any curve fitting and trying to use data to mold a level of modeling above that increasingly gets towards something that's quite abstract in the sense that we can understand mechanistically. So we ended up with this thing called either a one-dimensional or a multi-dimensional mapping, a discrete mapping, which the details of which are far beyond the scope of this talk. But the point was that this is a very reduced mathematical description, and yet having derived that, we understand very much what's happening in those maps, and some curves, these like bifurcation curves in a sense, predict quite well, both qualitatively and to some extent quantitatively, the transitions between bursting and seizing in CA1 versus CA3 for this particular network, despite the fact that we made some basically spherical Carroll type of assumptions. Okay, so something was good in what we did, right? Something. And I think that the fact that some of our assumptions were laid bare in this hierarchy gives people a chance to really lock in to figure out where, you know, how to do much better. And people have already been doing that, of course. Okay. So because I'm basically thinking of this work as a sort of prototype for predicting how to think about physiologically relevant parameter changes in mechanistic models across scales. And so I think that provides an anchor for experimental testing of assumptions and predictions. So again, this has been mentioned this morning as well, is that models aren't just to reproduce data. We want to make predictions that are testable and lead to an iterative process in science. And so some of the potential processes important in epilepsy could be maybe anchored onto hypothesized changes in our parameters, and that gives us a ground for proceeding. Okay, so that's just a sort of example of what I mean. So one of the issues in doing this kind of thing, and I'm borrowing some slides from my colleague Ilona, she's been doing a sort of meta-analysis, and I think this is something as well that is crucially missing in our community. This the community, that's probably the scientists in general, there's a bias against doing this kind of work. It's not very fundable, and it doesn't solve very concrete problems immediately. And that sort of concerns me, because I really think this idea of meta-study of how models fit together is actually going to be the crucial thing that will get us to another level of competence in mathematical modeling. So the kind of work that she's doing is she's considering the literature of different models of the respiratory system. And this is the biophysics of respiration. And again, details aren't really relevant here, but there's different levels of abstraction that she finds in the literature, and she's trying to compare the assumptions explicitly and figure out, you know, how to make the jumps between these things and how well do they fit together. And I think that's not just administration. I think that's actually a fundamentally important thing, although it's somewhat frowned upon for whatever reason. And the neural side of this process in the brainstem, in the pre-Butzinger complex, there are different levels, again, of complexity in the types of models, and she's interested in trying to connect together how these things work from simple to complex, trying to figure out the emergence of dynamics, and then re-simplify to these abstract concepts of you know, understanding a mechanism. Right? So this is a process that I think is absolutely vital to understanding multi-scale diseases, and this is just a particular example of that. Okay, so that's my spiel about modeling. I also think it's not for lack of data, right, is the problem that we have. So in Wired magazine, another famous quote that some of you might know, the quest for knowledge used to begin with grand theories, now it begins with massive amounts of data. Welcome to the petabyte age. Well, that's already turned into the exabyte age, and I don't care, because I think we're overly obsessed with data. And data collection is great, but we aren't spending enough money in proportion on generating hypotheses. And as mathematicians and people who are involved in math, I think we need to stand up and make more of a noise about that. In fact, even the head of the USA's NSF, Office of Cyber Infrastructure, admits that we don't know how to do data-driven science. And yet they're funding these projects that are very largely based on data collection and analysis, and not about the hypotheses that turn that data into information. And so I think we're not taking that seriously enough. It's also a connected issue, because you can't generate all this data without large computing power. And high-performance computing is great for creating raw data, and it's certainly lucrative and an easy place to go. And like I said, I'm playing devil's advocate, so I'm somewhat simplifying this issue, but still makes the general point. We get shiny things from these large computers that do these gigantic simulations like Markrams and so forth, and it does look very glossy and produces very pretty visualizations. I'm claiming, though, that these brutes, as the metaphor would go, you know, are turning into a hammer so that everything looks like a nail. And I think we're missing some elements in the mathematical modeling that can make better use of the high-performance computing. Okay. So one of my favorite quotes of Markram in his TED talk was, this says, so let's switch it on and then see stuff happen, right? So this is his model of a cortical microcolumn. And, I'm using him as a straw man, because I know he's a really smart guy and that he does a lot of good work in this area, but I'm just using him to make this general point. Okay, if you just throw these equations at a large computer, you get this as your output. How do we know what on earth is going on? We haven't necessarily specified things like what is the desired function and behavior. How do we know that the model did anything? This could be really representing the activity of someone in a coma or someone milliseconds from death because it's so dysfunctional, right? And we aren't going to know the difference at this stage. So how do we bring, this is the informatics, right? How do we bring constraints into this to satisfy ourselves that we really know what's actually happening here and that we've done a good job? How sensitive is the network to changes in parameters and so forth? We've had these things mentioned this morning that are very important. What's that? Oh, yeah. If you've got a laser pointer, you can just sit there and try to delete it like that. we had mentioned this morning these issues of motifs, and I think that's a really, really important thing for us to concentrate on, because I think these recognizing where these organizing principles are is one of the key ways to join this stuff up so that we can understand causal mechanisms. So my point that I want to become more constructive is to say that we don't really have the right representations yet in computational neuroscience or computational modeling, right? And so I'm making a metaphor here, which is that we wouldn't try to program some large software system directly in CPU code. I mean, that's obvious to us now, right? People would have to do this 50 years ago, or whatever, 60 maybe. But we certainly don't any longer, okay? If we have a complex problem, we break the problem up and we use appropriate representations in high-level languages in order to, you know, build the things in the way that makes sense to us intuitively. So my metaphor is that this stuff, when we build differential equations and similar things, to me is more or less equivalent to trying to code a complex system in terms of ones and zeros, right? These are the raw elements of a model, or one type of model of neural systems. And yet, we're missing some of the bigger pictures when we think about the systems level. And we would like, really, to be building these things in a more systematic, rational way in these kinds of terms. But we don't really have the technology to bridge that gap and to see exactly how to settle the parameters in a way that makes sense to put them into a black box, or not black box, but a block, over here. Okay? And it's mainly because of the nonlinearities and the multiple scales, and there's lots of parameters, and we don't know how to control all those things so that we keep the behavior in the place that we want them to be. Right, so that's a problem. So let's be a little more positive and say, you know, identify what's missing and then maybe, you know, talk about what to do about it. So the summary of that is that we need understanding across levels, and that means turning data into information. And that requires hypotheses and theories. Right? So I think we need an intermediate ground that we don't yet have in modeling. And we've seen already this morning and this afternoon aspects where you take a real system and you'll turn it either into a pretty detailed model or to a very toy model, right? Toy model including, you know, weakly coupled oscillators as an example, or you know, all sorts of other ones, and integrating fire neurons and simplistic networks that we stand a chance of understanding something about mathematically. But there's something in between, and we're not talking about it. We're not doing anything about it, it seems to me. Or there's relatively few, put it that way, people who are trying to do something about it. And that's some kind of parsimonious model which uses these heterogeneous representations, and that is sort of built in a context-dependent way. So that's what I'd like to talk more about. Right. So before I get to that, sort of the plan for progress that I think is emerging to me and to the colleagues who I see talk about these different issues, so just sort of to present it to you as a sort of review, is that we should be doing more meta-studies with our models and be more transparent about the assumptions, and to throw in more sort of diagnostics and validation when we do modeling. And we should be pushing journals to be more strict about requiring some of this information when we publish these things, if we're going to move on. But in the medium term, because I think it's harder, is we need to do things like figure out how to build data-driven multi-level models. And that includes things like knowing how to tune models in ways that are better than by hand, but that in the short term may involve computer-assisted supervision and qualitative reasoning. Now, I could talk a lot about that, but I'm not going to today. We don't necessarily, there are also problems in mathematics that we haven't solved yet, like stochastics in, you know, differential equations and bifurcations and so forth. So even without that, we can do these things and we'll be in a lot better shape. So like I said, there were some precedents for some of these things coming dating back to the 1990s. But I think we're in a particularly good place right now to apply these ideas and get on with it. So, like I said, I'm not going to talk about the qualitative fitting of models to data, which I think is a really important component of this. What I'm going to talk more about is making context-dependent reductions to what are called hybrid models, which I'll explain as we go on. But these things are a modular way to build these interoperable things. There's all this jargon, right, that we use in this area. But I think we stand a chance of understanding something if we approach this. So this is my personal take on how to, you know, approach this challenge with something in my research. And it's based on the concept, I guess, of reverse engineering, right? So if I think I know how something works, I'm going to build a model of it, and I'm not going to stop there. I'm going to mess around with it and stretch it and then break it and then figure out why it broke and sort of rebuild it. So I'm going to show you a quick example of something that's older work of mine along these lines, which is to talk about the single action potential, very modest little thing, which turned out to be more complicated when you get into the details. And then the second part is to talk more about the phase response curve, which I'm very grateful that has been introduced already, because as has been brought up earlier, we haven't addressed this really important issue of when do the assumptions of the PRC make sense. A lot of people use the PRC, right, in their research, and yet we don't necessarily understand why it works and where it originates from, and you know, what is the amount of weakness that we're allowed to have, and so forth. Okay, and I think that's an interesting thing that we can address with the techniques that I'm going to talk about. So, a paper with Horacio Rothstein, who's just over there, and Nancy a few years ago, we presented a sort of tool, somewhat computational tool, based on the idea of asymptotics, but relaxed in some sense, so that we don't just have things that make sense mathematically in the asymptotic limit, but in a finite limit that we can study and manage the constraints for. And it really boils down, it's quite fortunate for the Hodgkin-Huxley style equations that we can write the voltage equation as well as the gating variables in this formalism, right, mathematically. And that just comes from some simple algebra. And when we do that, we can think of this infinity value for V much like the M infinity and N infinity steady state activation curves. Right, so it's like a quasi-static fixed point. And the idea of an influence strength, as we're going to define it, is basically a sensitivity of the motion of that quasi-static fixed point to changes in the other variables. And we're going to see what power that actually gives us to analyze this thing. Okay, so it's an algorithmic form of multiple scale analysis. And what it does is it helps to pick out which variables are most relevant to the dynamics at a given moment in time. And of course that changes through time. It's a very nonlinear, you know, non-stationary system. I'm not going to go through the derivations of these various sensitivities, but I think most of you appreciate what a sensitivity is as a sort of derivative. And the different things that these can measure tell us when variables are fast and slow relative to each other and when they're strong and weak. And that's not necessarily the same as fast and slow. All right? And then we have some algorithm that keeps track of when these things change in some reasonable way and breaks up the action potential into what I'm calling regimes, which are these sort of discrete, low-dimensional representations. Within each one, I can basically boil down to a two-dimensional system from the four dimensions of the original Hodgkin-Huxley, although this can be applied to any conductance-based model, but we just did this with Hodgkin-Huxley, and come up with some sort of logical rules that encode what it means to be in one of these regimes in a way that's now sort of abstracted from the details of the dynamics. And so I would claim, I suppose, that this is one way of saying that we're merging the idea of informatics with doing dynamics. So the dynamics are absolutely there. All the details in the simulation and the differential equations are all there, but I'm not making a priori assumptions about weak and strong things and fast and slow things. I'm letting those emerge and letting the computer figure out where those are and making an abstraction based on that, which I then need to use the computer to keep track of, because it's just too complex for me to do. All right? So let's not worry about the details. All right, I was going to show the video, but I can at the end if I have time. But basically, the video shows the voltage trace in a phase plane, just to show you how complex it is when you think just about the dynamical systems problem with these very nonlinear functions that are in the kinetics. So representing the action potential basically drops us into these four regimes that have been coarse-grained in this particular way. And so something that's different to the traditional mathematical route is that we don't need these asymptotic analyses. And in other words, we actually get a handle on how weak has to be for this to work built into this analysis. Because the upshot is that this is more of a numerical technique or semi-analytical technique, but we get to estimate what the weakness is here, right? Weak as in weak coupling or whatever, what the epsilon is, how big the epsilon is. But we do get to understand it fairly intuitively in terms of being able to draw these block diagrams and talk about things being frozen and moving slowly and so forth. And the other thing I think that it's nice that gives us is that this is a self-contained mathematical description. The asymptotic analysis is great until you realize that what you actually have to say as you move through this regime here is that N and H become so slow they have to be fixed. And then you have to ask yourself, well, how do they actually progress quasi-statically in order to get the dynamics? The representation in that formalism does not tell you how to move N and H appropriately through that regime. And that's sort of just left to magic, I guess. But this gives you a self-consistent representation, even though it's approximate. And this is how approximate it is. It's only qualitatively matching. Obviously, I'm not going for smoothness here. That wasn't the point of this representation. The representation was trying to understand what's essential in each of these stages and to just get an action potential overall. So the hybrid model, which is the stitched together models of these pieces, gives us the solid line compared to the original models. And the same template works for different types of model, which I think gives again sort of an informatic abstraction of what it means to be an action potential using sodium and potassium that has been somewhat abstracted from the details of exactly how the currents have their kinetics. So long as they pass through that template I showed earlier, I can get all kinds of models to fit this template. And I feel like that allows me to learn something about what it means to be an action potential and understand the mechanisms. Right, so that's one of my examples. So this is about locally reduced modeling, right? So I've mentioned half of these things already. The idea of how big is the epsilon is the issue of having an explicit domain of validity for these models. And, you know, we have to do all kinds of other things, right? There's a lot of details in there. It involves global consistency checks and bookkeeping of all of these conditions that have to be matched. And this is the rub, I think, of what the issue is in moving forward in this sort of grand multi-level modeling that I'm advocating for, is that humans can't do this. We need tools that help us to do that for us. And that doesn't just mean these big, powerful computers. It means smart software that enables us to manage these constraints in a way that we would if we could as a human in a heuristic way, but that we need help with. And as we'll see when we talk about the PRC, this is a great way to deal with transients. And I timed the sun to come out at that point so that it shines light on the sort of glory of the application that I'll describe now. All right, so phase response curves, as we've already seen, very popular way to explain higher level emergence of synchronization and other sort of timing properties in networks based on this single cell, or not necessarily single cell properties. We can measure PRCs of whole subsystems and represent them as an oscillator. So they have a lot of power as an explanatory tool, provided we can ground the PRC itself in something mechanistically. And that's what's actually missing in the literature right now. We can always compute these things empirically or numerically, but we don't necessarily know why it has the shape that it does. Right? So we can change a parameter and see what effect it has, but I can't explain to my grandmother why it changed its shape. Right? And that's what I'm interested in right now. So we've also mentioned isochrones. This was the isochrone, okay, that Tim put down for us. Right, so isochrones are this important concept, and you know, I've asked some of my colleagues, well, do we understand PRCs? And they sort of, well, some of them say, yes, we do, because we know what isochrones are. And that's, to me, that passes the buck somewhat. Right? Isochrones are important, and they are certainly a component of what's going on here, so that when we perturb from a point, we can figure out which asymptotic phase we're on, so that we know where we will end up. But why does it have its shape? Right? It passes the buck. So to study the transients, I'm going to extend the concept of an isochrone to local windows, and this picture is appropriate, because even though there's a limit cycle, like this is a limit cycle here, I'm going to focus on studying such a thing in a very small domain at a time and see what we can do. We have to change the technology a little bit because defining phase is not as easy or as obvious, and we don't even need periodicity to do this, which is appropriate for transients. There's some work of Judy Day and Carsten Chow and John Rubin started to talk about transients in this way, and they did some local analysis with linear systems which I'm actually going to take advantage of and then blow up into a much bigger kind of idea, is that we can define an isochrone for a local system. And I don't want to go through a lot of the details because I'm sure many of you would be bored by too much math at this point. But the idea is that we can set up a two-dimensional linear model, so you'll see why I do this shortly, and we can put an exit boundary down near the fixed point, and we can talk about the approach of different trajectories that may be perturbed from each other towards this exit boundary, given that we know in advance, because we've computed things about this fixed point, what these eigenvalues are and eigenvectors, and therefore where we will approach along. And we can say various things about which one will get through there first based on a knowledge of these eigenvectors. So these eigenvectors play the role of an isochrone, right? So if these lines are obviously parallel to the strong stable manifold, which is one of the eigenvectors, and any perturbation that puts you in front relative to that line will mean you get there first. So that defines relative phase in this local manner. It gets a bit harder with a focus. Unfortunately, I had to deal with this case because when you see what I did next, it turns out that I have foci in my local dynamics. Foci are harder because the eigenvectors are actually complex, and therefore they don't. There's no strong stable manifold anymore. But for now, you know, you can just sort of believe me that what I've done computationally is figure out that for a given exit boundary that I lay down, that I can still compute an isochron surrogate line, some vector, maybe Hinker or some other people who might be able to help me figure this out, because I've only just started analyzing it. But I can, I'm pretty certain that because of the linearity of the system, I could analytically figure out what this vector would be, such that if I'm behind it, then I will be delayed to this point, and if I'm in front of it, I will be ahead of point B. Okay? So those are the ways I'm going to define local phase. And so here's my phase response curve, type 2, what we saw earlier. In other words, it has a delay part and an advanced part for a type 2 Hodgkin-Huxley cell. And that's plotted in blue. And I'm going to just call this the spike time difference map, because I'm just not going to make any asymptotic approximations. Just going to say make this a finite thing, and that's what we call it when we do that. And it actually lines, so interestingly, it lines up with these regimes that I already am measuring with my dominant scale analysis. And this led me to think, is this just a coincidence that when this dips down like that, this regime that is dominated by a slow movement of the potassium activation, is that relevant to why there's a phase delay there? Okay, because it's really not obvious to people why there should be a phase delay at that point. So type 1, as many of you know, simple neurons will always have a positive phase advance whenever there's a positive excitatory input. Okay, so make some approximations that allow us to proceed. So four dimensions at the beginning. I checked, if you take out the sodium inactivation, I can still get the spike. I can't get the recovery, but I don't care about the recovery right now. I'm interested in the transient dynamics over here. Okay, so given that, I can throw away H and hold it at a value that's appropriate to being around this part of the dynamics. So now I have a three-dimensional system. I see that there's almost no effect on this spike-time difference map when I take away H, so I'm going to take that as my green light to analyze this three-dimensional model. And now I'm going to make a sort of microscopic low-dimensional model, hybrid model of these pieces to try to figure out how this happens. Okay, so let's make some initial observations. Let's pick this time around here. About time is 5.88 from my initial condition here. And this is about the minimum of the PRC. So this is what the trajectory looks like in the potassium and voltage phase plane, because remember we've got three variables, so there's two phase planes with voltage in each one on the y-axis. And I'm going to study this sort of regime just around here. And I'm going to look at exit times using these voltage lines as a sort of surrogate for things that are more complicated. When am I going to pass through these voltage points through these local analyses around here and here? And these null clines, well, obviously the green ones are stationary because they only depend on V, but the black null cline, which is the V null cline, unfortunately moves. And that's the very essence of having a higher dimensional system here, is that no one phase plane will nail this, right? Because as M varies, this curve will vary in this plane. So we have a problem. Right, we'll come back to that. So let's measure what the exit times are through these various stages in that very local regime. We find something really rather interesting. We find that the exit time is actually advanced for the perturbation at the beginning of this forward sort of simulation. So that initial perturbation that happens where we know that there's eventually a delay in the phase response is actually an initial advance of a half the amount of the final delay. Okay? And then through these next stages at 5, 10, and then 20 millivolts, the delay somehow accrues. So we have a very non-local dynamic effect going on here. Right? And this is well known to people, and I have a former life as a former academic life as someone who studies the science of means, so I couldn't help myself. This may not mean anything to some of you, but I just can't help it. So, the issue is that you can't simply freeze the coefficients and study the variational equation, which is what the sort of naive approach would be here. Right? It's much more complicated than that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do something that I don't really see anybody doing, and hopefully it's not completely balmy, otherwise I'm going to embarrass myself, but I think that what's interesting around this state that I'm interested in here is that I don't even care that there's a sort of nominal fixed point over here, which has somehow got moved, because the local dynamics here don't even see that. In fact, that might not even be there by the time the dynamics actually gets there, because this female cline is changing all the time. What I care about is going on right here. So what I'm going to do to represent this dynamics, and we're in the ghost of a saddle node bifurcation, that the V null cline has just pulled through that green line and killed a couple of fixed points down here and opened us up to proceed, is that I'm going to linearize, this is like a blow up of that area, I'm going to linearize the null clines locally to the state that I'm interested in, and these straight lines define a virtual fixed point. And again, I am not the first person to talk about a virtual fixed point, so maybe there's some hope that it's a reasonable idea here. But there's also a lot of talk about rivers in this kind of literature, which is when you have a limit cycle or some other compressive dynamics onto a limit cycle or something like that. Why is the river that it is? Why do these things come and converge on this place? Well, it turns out when you do this kind of linearization that the weak stable manifold locally defines the river. Right? That your state will track that vector for a brief amount of time before you reset what this local linearization means. Okay? So the problem is these things aren't stationary, right? And this is the sort of multi-million dollar question, I wish, which is to figure out how to keep track of these lines as they change. Right? So a couple of milliseconds later, these are quite significantly different. If you check the scales here, things have moved along, and these fixed points are moving, so that's obviously a problem, but if we do this carefully in a numerically sort of intelligent way, we can take steps just like we do when we integrate differential equations with an integration scheme. We can take time steps that are appropriate to the time scales of things that are changing. Right? Now, so the concept here then is that I can understand these linear systems at any given instant in time. I know everything. I've got a closed form solution. I know exactly how the parameters and so forth affect the angles and positions of these things. And so for some short amount of time, I have a very, very good understanding of what controls the dynamics of the state. And fortunately, I also know a lot about why that happens to be the linearization that it is, because it turns out that the dominant scale analysis that I told you earlier measures exactly such things as the rate of change of this null cline with respect to other variables. And that actually helps me keep track of conditions that ensure that this is a safe way to proceed. And technicalities, obviously, I'm not going to go into here. But it allows me to say something very interesting about if I make a voltage perturbation here, how does that change the orbit that I'll have locally? And then how do I pass that information on when I make these next steps to figure out what will continue to happen to that perturbation as I proceed? Okay? So nonlinear analysis of isochrones, which is sort of the more traditional approach, is actually very difficult. So instead I'm basically taking a piecewise linear approach, of which, again, there are many precedents of doing piecewise linear analyses. But I need the computer, in particular, I have a whole software package that I want to mention based in Python, which is not just for simulation, but it's to try to build the kinds of software tools that I've been talking about as a prototype, and let the computer help me bear the burden of all the details that I've got to keep track of when I do this. Right? So I still get an intuitive, if only approximate, analytic understanding of the mechanisms at work. And it's not just simulation. So the pictures I'm showing you aren't merely just things that I'm measuring through simulation. I know exactly why these things are here, and I know exactly how they're changing, and I know exactly how to relate that in a mathematical way to the parameters and the ionic properties of the cell. So this is the coarse-grained estimate. I'm just going to give you a couple of sort of instances of this happening to show you sort of what's going on. Here's my initial condition at my time 5.88, and my little perturbation right there, which is going to be the yellow line. The original orbits are in blue. Obviously, it's nonlinear. This black null cline is really moving in this time frame, so that's why this is actually bending. But on the appropriate time frame, a linear model will predict, you know, some exit time across this 2 millivolt boundary. Okay, there's actually 2 iterates involved in the real calculation, but I'm just showing you one to make it look easy. That's where the virtual fixed point is. And again, I don't have to calculate all this by hand. I wrote code that does it all for me, right? And I just press a couple of buttons, and it pops this up and figures it out. Right? So once I hit this boundary, I take that initial that final point and turn it into the initial point of another stage. Right? And I choose this plane because my dominant scale analysis told me that this was the plane that is the most safe plane to be working in, given that there are other variables moving around. Okay. So we have an elapsed time of about 1.2 milliseconds in this particular picture. Then my dominant scale analysis tells me I have to pass to the plane that involves the sodium activation and voltage, which starts me off down here in this picture. And when I do that, now I'm actually showing you the 4 iterates. These isochrones are the things, I didn't mention this was actually a focus, which is why I needed to figure out what that magic vector is, which, because this initial condition is ahead of it, means that it will be advanced. So I can actually explain the advance in this initial stage. Okay, so I know that the perturbation is advanced, and the predicted advance is almost exactly what I measured earlier from the original full dimensional system. So I take that information, start off 2 initial conditions here, and continue to iterate. While I do that, I can't help but, you know, this null cline is moving, unfortunately, but if I take small steps, it's not too big a deal, and I can get through the next boundary at +3 millivolts and have an elapsed time of 1.9 milliseconds. Okay, now I iterate each of these things through, and when I get to the end, I can get an error in the exit time differences of just a few percent of what I can measure directly in the PRC. In other words, I believe that tells me that, you know, I've got a sufficiently accurate micro to macro level understanding of how these things relate to each other. Okay, so I could continue iterating this thing all the way up to the top of the spike, or I could basically finish off with what I'm calling this scaffolding principle, which is that I've already got enough information to tell me where the delay has come. So this regime definitely predicts the delay, because the initial condition is behind the isochrone defined by the non-perturbed orbit, and when I propagate that through, I get the right answer. So I can just stitch this together with the original 4D model and finish to the final spike, and indeed, I do get the value very close to where the full model predicts. And there are all kinds of insights that I can glean from this. This is just the beginning of this project. You know, in particular, I get an insight here that at the stage of the M and V phase plane, I can actually hold V and M to be identical, and the only difference in those two states is a 10⁻⁵ difference in the potassium activation, and that is enough of a difference to give me, at this point, to give me the full amount of delay by the time I reach the top of the spike. Right? So it gives me all these interesting insights into what's really important at each stage of this process. And so that's what's going on here. There's this hugely expansive region which is sort of locally unstable. Think about the virtual fixed point is now a repeller. When these things come back and meet, they're repelling the dynamics up towards the spike, and very, very small differences there get magnified, and that's really where the delay is coming from. This is several milliseconds later from the initial perturbation, and so we have to keep track of those things to figure out, you know, how we got to where we are. Okay, so this is basically now the summary, so I'm basically done, but I wanted to summarize what I think I've done more broadly, because that's what's more interesting to you folks, which is to think that, you know, my concept is to take this complex system with many interacting parts and to have ways of measuring what's important in the structure. certainly have a specific question in mind, which drives what to measure and what to consider important, and to mine data for those features and motifs, modules, whatever you want to call them, and to do sensitivity analysis and bottlenecks and all the other kinds of jargon there, and figure out what are these sort of effective modules in the system. Okay, so that's something that's fairly obvious, and we already do that. But the concept then is to then hypothesize some pretty high-level conceptual models about how we think these pieces interact with each other, and then put our money where our mouth is. Not just simulate this whole system, but to break it apart into these sort of little pieces and make a model, basically, of each of these pieces and see how they interact with each other. And then we can apply data-driven constraints, but we can also apply hypothesis-driven constraints, because the hypotheses are how we think it's working. And if we put those hypotheses into the abstract model that is anchored in the sort of more real, detailed level, I think we stand a good chance of understanding what works. So that's working in this kind of way. I kind of cut out the little piece that I think is a module, replace it with something that's like a surrogate, the motif, and I impose surrogate inputs, which I believe is what's coming from the other part of the system, and I do some kind of analysis and maybe some kind of optimization or data or fitting or whatever, whether I do that by hand or with an automatic way. But I tune this model to behave like the little piece of the real thing. Okay, and I have to be very conscious and very honest about what works and what doesn't work, because that's critical to be able to go back to the larger picture later. Okay, and this is where I'm going to need qualitative features, which is, like I said, it's part that I can't talk about right here. But I have some results on doing qualitative fitting with these kinds of things. And then the key step is to recontextualize that little model that you've built and sort of drop it back in place of the part that you replaced, and recontextualize it within the original system and see how it behaves back in that place, and then maybe even do some retuning to see what happens. And that is a non-trivial thing to do without software. Okay, unless you're working with a really simple system, that is not an easy thing to hook up without getting a grad student to spend hours and hours and hours on it. Okay, so then you basically continue with each of these pieces until you believe you stitch together a hybrid model, and then I believe that this scaffolding approach is the best way that I can think of right now to come up with an understanding. So this is the last slide about the methodology and what I'm advocating here as a sort of skeptic. It's really just about these micro theories building up to an understanding of high-level emergent properties using informatic software tools, which is where this, I think, is most missing. And so I will leave you with my ad for my software, and thank you very much for your attention.
Just to get us back into epilepsy, can you at least approach the problem that Aaron was talking about in the context of this very high ticket oscillation?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I can't pretend to know an awful lot about Aaron's area, but I think the concept broadly is that... Yeah. Right.
Can we extract this concept using informatics and using measurements from actual
brain? Right. I mean, I think this approach gives you a way to think about how to build models that are very well constrained to conceptual details that you want to capture, as well as to quantitative things. I'm not sure whether this is answering your question, but I think the answer is yes. We can certainly talk about it more later, especially after some beer. I'll be much more able to think about that. But it gives you a process by which you can focus on features that you're interested in capturing in a model, and maybe give you a handle on how to search for that feature, given that it's going to exist in some high-dimensional parameter space where you don't know how to search. When you start constraining what's going on with these qualitative features, then in principle it can help to guide what happens. I've tried to create some examples of that in some other work that I've done, which I'm happy to show you, but I think the kind of idea that you're suggesting for areas is obviously a much larger magnitude of problem, and so I don't know, it's very hard. But we have to start somewhere, and that's the idea. Yeah.
Could you please bring up one of your first
Oh, right. It's not my picture. I think I stole that from a paper somewhere, but it's so long ago I've forgotten what the credit is for that. This one.
That the excitability of neurons depends on a number of humoral factors, on ions, on neurotransmitters, a dozen, 2 dozen species.
Mm-hmm.
So I imagine a vector or a vector field of concentration,
mm-hmm.
Of an n-dimensional vector field with species 1, 2, 3 up to n.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I don't take responsibility for this particular picture, but you know, I think all of these are different levels of analysis that we need to reconcile. And sure, and so I'm advocating an approach where we stand a chance of figuring out how we might reconcile some of those issues by having a very sort of concrete, informatic way to try to connect what the issues are at these different levels. Hinker? Right. Right. I think it's very much the same idea. I think this is a constructive way to approach that when you've got a network. I mean, I haven't shown this for networks. It's actually very hard to proceed when you've got multiple cells. I'm still, you know, trying. I mean, the original paper that inspired me to do this is still just two cells, and even figuring out how to do that in a very concrete way, more concrete than what Nancy and Bard did, it still remains quite difficult. But certainly, yeah, this approach absolutely identifies feedback loops which may only exist transiently because they're functional feedback loops. And it helps you to pin down where these things are so that you can focus on them and their role in the larger scheme and maybe give you a handle on where to look for ways to make those representations so that we can justify why we have a control theory model that fits in that particular scenario. I think they're actually really the same kind of way. This is just one example of how to measure something that enables us to feel confident that reduction is valid. But yeah, I think it's the same thing, seeking these loops. Yeah.
Just a question.